Let me begin, just because I know that often people get rushed at the end and have to rush through who did the work. Let me start off by acknowledging the people who I've worked on with this, on this project. Eric Brown was a graduate student at Princeton, where I did my postdoc at Princeton before coming here to Santa Barbara. He's now at Courant working with John Renzel. Phil Holmes, a professor at Princeton. If you know anything about Phil Holmes, you'll probably guess what sorts of techniques I'm going to bring to the problem, dynamical systems techniques. Then we collaborated with three experimentalists, Ed Clayton, Janusz Rajkowski, and Gary Aston Jones from the University of Pennsylvania. And we interacted quite a bit with Jonathan Cohen, who's a psychology professor at Princeton. And we had weekly meetings with Jonathan Cohen to sort of tell him what our thinking was on our model, and he would try to keep us honest and say, well, that doesn't sound reasonable, or whatever. Here are a couple publications that this work covers. Okay, so what I'm going to talk about, first of all, I'm going to introduce a region of the brain called the locus coeruleus, which I'll refer to as the LC, and describe how neurons in the locus coeruleus behave during what's called a visual discrimination task. Then I'll go through some mathematical modeling for neurons, including a very nice technique known as phase reduction. I'll show how you can use these phase-reduced equations to make predictions for so-called peristimulus time histograms, PSTHs. These are things that the experimentalists get very excited about and make measurements of. And then I'll summarize and talk just a little bit about some other applications. Okay, so my guess is that most of the people here have a physics background or something similar. So let me probably introduce, rather than remind you, about a region of the brain called the locus coeruleus. The locus coeruleus is this little green blob right here. So it's located basically at the top of the brain stem. It's a nucleus in the brain which consists of approximately 15,000 neurons for monkeys. There's one nucleus in each hemisphere, one in the left, one in the right. For humans, there are on the order of 35,000 neurons in the locus coeruleus. Now, you may say, well, there are billions and billions of neurons in the brain. Surely something which only has 15,000 can't be that important. But in fact, these LC neurons are quite important. One measure of that is that each neuron can make more than 250,000 synapses or connections to other neurons. And to give you an idea of where those connections go, back on this slide, the green arrows show the projections from the locus coeruleus. You see that it communicates with the cortex and the cerebellum and important regions of the brain like that. Now, LC neurons release a neurotransmitter known as norepinephrine, which has been shown to regulate various cognitive functions such as arousal, sleep-wake cycles, memory, learning, stress, and things like that. Okay. So now I want to describe an experiment done in the Aston Jones lab at the University of Pennsylvania, which I refer to as a visual discrimination task. Basically, what you have is a monkey sitting there watching TV, okay? But on TV, instead of seeing, you know, the latest Apprentice episodes or whatever the current hot shows are, they just see a sequence of very simple visual stimuli, such as a horizontal bar or a vertical bar. Now, the way the experiment usually goes is the monkey, first of all, has to depress a lever and then fixate its eyes on the screen, and they're able to measure how concentrated, in some sense, the monkey is if its eyes are fixated for a long enough time. After they're fixated long enough, they present one of these visual stimuli. The monkey has been trained to respond to a target stimulus, such as the horizontal bar, and if it sees the stimulus, it's supposed to release the lever. And if it does this correctly, then it gets rewarded by getting some juice. If it does it incorrectly, well, he's, quote, punished by having to wait a little while until he has another chance to get some more juice. Okay, and they did different combinations of, you know, 20% of all stimuli are target stimuli, 80% are non-target. you know, instead, here it's very obvious that this is horizontal, this is vertical. They did variations where it was a little less clear which was which. But at any rate, this is the basic idea. He has to choose between, he has to identify the stimulus as one of two different choices and respond accordingly. I should mention, incorrect responses come in two different forms. One is when the monkey releases the lever when he shouldn't have released the lever. This is known as a false alarm. The other one is where the target stimulus is presented and he keeps the lever down. Okay. So here I want to show some experimental data for a visual discrimination task. Again, this was done in the Aston Jones lab. It was found that the monkey alternated between approximately 10-minute intervals of good and poor performance. And you can see that this, a little hard to read, this says FA rate, that's false alarm rate as a function of time. False alarms are where the monkey releases the lever when he shouldn't have. And you see that the false alarm rate is relatively high for some time, then it becomes essentially zero, then it becomes high, essentially zero, and so on. Okay, now the upper slide shows these are simultaneous, the time here is the same as the time here. You see this is the instantaneous firing rate of the neuron. You see that when the false alarm rate is relatively high, the firing rate is high. When the false alarm rate is low, the firing rate is low, and so on.
Sorry, what's the, how are they measuring?
Yeah, they're using electrodes. They're actually measuring in the LC, the neurons in the locus coeruleus. Most of the measurements they did were just measuring a single neuron, but they also were able to measure two different neurons simultaneously and find cross correlograms. I'll get to that a little bit later. But basically, they're just, you know, they just stick the electrode in essentially randomly, so they get a quote typical neuron. And just make measurements with that neuron for, the monkey seems to be quite happy doing this task, and so they can get him to do it for maybe an hour or two straight. And so they're able to get quite a lot of data essentially from the same neuron. Okay? They, in later iterations, so this is from 1999, they're now able to measure something like 16 neurons simultaneously for these experiments, but I'll mostly be focused on these older ones. Okay, so some more of their experimental data is shown here. These are so-called peristimulus time histograms, and let me explain how these are generated. So remember, the monkey is sitting there watching TV, seeing these visual stimuli. What you do is you say each of these stimuli is presented at t equals zero. So you essentially just define t equals zero as when the stimulus comes on. And then you measure when the neuron is spiking relative to that t equals zero. And you make a histogram of the results. Okay, so for the first presentation of the stimulus, you might find, well, here's when the stimulus is presented. You might find the neuron fires here, here, and here. So you get ticks in those places. Then the next time through, maybe it spikes here, here, and here. You do this over and over, maybe 100 trials, couple hundred trials, and build up a histogram that looks something like this. And so this is giving some sort of average firing rate of the neuron relative to stimulus presentation. Okay. So now remember on the last slide I mentioned that the monkeys alternated between these intervals of good performance and poor performance. When the monkey was performing well, they called this the phasic state. The properties of the phasic state, okay, shows good performance. The neurons fire slower on average than the other state, on the order of 2 spikes per second. You have a larger response to stimulus, by which I mean in these PSTHs, after the stimulus comes, you have a more prominent peak. Okay, so you see here there's quite a prominent peak. Here you can identify a little peak, but perhaps it's not so prominent. In the phasic state, when they did these multi-neuron recordings, they found that the neurons tended to be more synchronous with each other. Okay, this is contrasted with the so-called tonic state, where the monkey is performing poorly, the baseline firing rate is faster, on the order of 3 spikes per second. The way you can see that in these PSTHs, the same number of trials were recorded for both the left and the right. You see, before the stimulus comes, there's less spikes over here than over here. Okay, so in the tonic state, there's a faster baseline firing rate. Then there's a smaller response to stimulus, which is essentially what I said before. This peak is less prominent than this peak, and the neurons display less synchrony. Okay, so what we wanted to do, so we became aware of this data and thought that it would be interesting to try to pin down the relationships between baseline firing rate of the neurons and their responsiveness as measured by essentially these peaks that occur after the stimulus presentation. Okay, any questions on the experiments before I go on?
What is the latency of the peak?
The latency of the peak, you mean how?
Yeah.
Well, I should have mentioned, so what you notice from the plots is that you get this peak, and then the neurons tend not to fire at all. Well, perhaps a few spikes here and there. And then you essentially return back to the baseline firing rate. So this time is in milliseconds. So you see that, you know, there's a couple hundred milliseconds where the neurons essentially don't fire at all.
So is it driven by other V1 neurons? Is there anatomical connections?
Right. So I'll confess slight ignorance of how everything is wired together. But ultimately what's happening is it sees a visual stimulus. The visual processing system in the brain does its work. And ultimately there's some sort of signal which is coming into the locus coeruleus. Okay, it's some sort of signal that says, hey, I just saw something. And so I'm going to be slightly fuzzy on exactly how you get to that point. But I mean, that's the overall philosophy, that ultimately the visual stimulus gets translated to a current stimulus coming into the locus coeruleus. I'm sure the details of how that happens are quite interesting, but I'm not really the person to ask about that. Okay? Okay, so I'm sure that many of you in the room know a lot about this, and probably more than I do, but let me just go through a few minutes of the style of modeling I like to do. What I like to do is to start with pretty realistic models of the neurons, okay, such as a Hodgkin-Huxley model, and then do some sort of reduction technique which allows me to do more analysis than I could do on the realistic model. So what's going on in the Hodgkin-Huxley model? Well, here's the biophysics of the membrane of a neuron. You have a lipid bilayer, which electrically acts as a capacitor. You have protein molecules that pierce through this lipid membrane and are able to allow ions to flow from the inside or to the outside or vice versa, depending on different things binding to the molecules and so on. What Hodgkin and Huxley did was to take this biophysical situation and associate an electrical circuit with it. And the way I like to think about this is, suppose you stick your electrode in your neuron, inject some current, how can the current go from the inside to the outside? Well, there are several different paths it can take. There's a so-called capacitive current associated with the lipid bilayer. And then there are certain ions that like to flow back and forth, sodium, potassium. And then my understanding is Hodgkin and Huxley, this is for a squid giant axon. They essentially took a squeegee to this axon and squeegeed out all the little juices that were inside and did an analysis of what all was in there, and they identified something like 40 different ions or something like that. And you know, I'm willing to cut them some slack. They said, well, we're not going to try to model all of these ion channels individually. We believe that sodium and potassium are the most important. Let's lump everything else back together in the so-called leak current. Okay, so these are the main pathways that the current can flow from inside to outside or vice versa. Here I draw these as nonlinear resistors that's associated with the protein molecules. And there are batteries here because the cells expend a huge amount of energy to maintain concentration differences between the inside and the outside. That corresponds to voltage differences. You can view these as essentially ion pumps. Okay. I'm not going to show you the equations. Many of you have seen these and studied these in detail. I just want to remind you of some results when you numerically simulate the equations. This is voltage as a function of time. The voltage builds up slowly. Then you get a so-called action potential where it goes up rapidly, goes back down, builds up slowly. The behavior depends on the value of the injected current. Here I've chosen this value. Yeah, question?
Okay, so just to, I think I lost where you're going. So
okay.
Is the idea that you have basically these two different firing, PSTHs.
Right.
How can you explain how the same neuron getting more or less the same input but with some modulating factor can be in those states?
Exactly, yeah. So they're measuring the same neuron. The same neuron shows this tonic behavior and phasic behavior. There seems to be a correlation in the data, a strong correlation between baseline firing rate of the neuron and the responsiveness of the neuron. So our philosophy is going to be, well, somehow the neurons in the LC are getting some background bias currents and so on. And perhaps by changing those bias currents, you change the baseline firing rate of the neurons, and therefore that changes the responsiveness. So we want to sort of pin down, and so I should have made that point more clearly. I'm talking about the same neurons can exhibit one of the two states, and so we want to try to understand, the details of how that can happen.
Okay, so one more related question is, there are infinite numbers of more complicated models that you could have started with.
Sure.
But you're sort of looking just for the sort of some minimal description that's still
realistic.
That's reasonable. Is that?
Yeah, that's essentially true. Right. So here I'm starting with Hodgkin-Huxley because people have a tendency to know a lot about Hodgkin-Huxley. I'm not going to claim that LC neurons obey the Hodgkin-Huxley equations. Okay. But I'm going to argue very quickly that another model is more appropriate. From my perspective, and of course the biologists get upset when you say something like this, but from my perspective, there's only a few different classes of neurons which can be classified based on the type of bifurcation which gives rise to periodic firing. Okay, so from my perspective, the details of all of the currents which go into the model are important, but perhaps of secondary importance. To me, it's more the bifurcation that's important. Okay, so that's my bias to the proceedings. Okay, so here's voltage as a function of time. This is a so-called FI plot. Frequency is a function of the input current. As long as I is large enough, the injected current is large enough, you get periodic firing. If it's too small, you don't get periodic firing. You just go to a steady state. You see that for the standard Hodgkin-Huxley equations, this is using the standard parameters. The firing frequency is always 50 hertz or greater, and as I increases, the frequency increases. Okay. So now what I want to do is to describe how we go from the Hodgkin-Huxley equations, which are fairly nasty, that's a set of four coupled highly nonlinear ordinary differential equations, to a much simpler description. This is called a phase reduction. Here I'm showing phase space. This is the voltage. N is a gating variable associated with these ionic flows. The bold line here is for this particular value of I, the stable periodic orbit. And the dotted lines here are so-called isochrons. So let me describe what's going on with isochrons. The idea is, it's a stable periodic orbit. So if I start slightly off the periodic orbit and evolve the system, I collapse onto the periodic orbit. Now, if I start with two initial conditions on the same isochron and integrate both those initial conditions, and as t goes to infinity, they asymptotically approach the same phase on the periodic orbit. Okay. And you can label the isochrons with an angular variable. Here I say theta equals 0. It's where the voltage reaches its peak. That is sort of at the peak of the action potential. Here's another isochron. I've drawn 20 different isochrons, just numerically computed for the Hodgkin-Huxley equations. And I should mention that I've spaced these isochrons equally in time, which means the time it takes. So I have 20 different isochrons. If I start on this isochron and a period divided by 20, I end up on this isochron. Another period over 20, I end up on this isochron. And so you can see that because the isochrons are more dense over here, the neuron spends more time in this region of phase space. Okay, and the action potential is where the voltage goes up very quickly and comes back down. You can see that because the isochrons are quite diffuse. Now it turns out in the isochron variables, these theta variables, the equations become quite simple. They just become d theta dt is equal to omega, where omega is 2 pi over the period for the neuron.
Is it the same as action angle variables?
I don't think it's exactly the same. It's there are different ways that people do these phase reductions. You can do it geometrically. You can just define a point here and say that I measure the angle, a point and a line, I measure the angle relative to that. There's something called, you assume there's strong attraction. This is something that Capel and Ehrmantraut looked at a little bit. This seems to be, in some sense, the nicest way to do the phase reduction, because you get this simple equation, d theta dt equals omega. For the other types of reduction, you get something more complicated. I don't know. Maybe it has to do with the angle variables. That's an interesting question. My gut instinct is that they're not exactly the same, but that might be worth pursuing.
Can you comment on this line that every isochron?
Okay, yes. Yeah, so I haven't drawn in this picture because it was already fairly cluttered, but you can draw null clines, so-called null clines for the equations. The Hodgkin-Huxley equations are actually four-dimensional, but you can do some reduction to make them two-dimensional. So let me assume that we've done that, just so we can think about it a little easier. The so-called V-null cline, that's the surface on which dV dt is equal to zero. Okay, that null cline has sort of a cubic shape, comes up and down like this. The N-null cline, where dN dt is equal to zero, goes something like this. Okay, it turns out that these isochrons, well, the N-null cline is actually kind of like this. It turns out that these isochrons all sort of accumulate on this branch of the V-null cline, okay, sort of the middle branch of the V-null cline. And if you follow them in, they all spiral around. You can make cool figures. It's fairly difficult to, you know, interpret what exactly is going on, where it gets quite complicated. But you can think of this system, I think ultimately the reason why the isochrons accumulate here, you can think of it as a fast-slow system where the V variable evolves much faster than the N variable. And in the limit that it's infinitely fast, you would say, okay, if I start here, I'm going to instantly shoot in a horizontal line over to the periodic orbit. Okay, so the idea is, well, if in fact it was, the time scale was infinitely fast, these isochrons, I believe, would be vertical lines that go over to this sort of quote unstable branch of the V null cline. I don't know, that might be more detail than you wanted, but I mean, there is a reason why they look the way they do. But ultimately, you can just calculate them numerically.
If I get bigger, does that thing get bigger and I get smaller, shrink down sort of proportionally?
The periodic orbit?
Yeah.
It does certainly change its shape slightly. I think that the main effect is really that the period changes, the amount of time to go around, but the actual shape in phase space, I think, stays relatively constant. But yeah, and the isochrons will sort of move around a little bit. But this this general structure remains the same, that the isochrons are much more diffuse over here where the action potential happens.
That's the direction. If I gets bigger, does that thing get smaller or bigger?
The periodic orbit? I honestly don't know the answer to that. I mean,
if I gets bigger, the frequency goes up, so does that mean that the thing must shrink so it can get around there faster?
I don't think there's a simple monotonic statement of how it changes with I.
Because there's no time there. You can just go around the loop faster.
Yeah. I mean, it's just that, you know, for I equals 10, perhaps I go around at this speed. At I equals 20, okay, I go around the same path at a faster speed. Okay, so this is the phase reduction. So the idea is we're taking a fairly complicated object in phase space, and really we can think of it as just movement around a circle at some frequency omega. Okay, here I want to give a little more detail on this reduction procedure. What I should have mentioned over here, when I write dx dt equals f of x, here I'm thinking of these are the Hodgkin-Huxley equations, and then I reduce to equations that look like this. What I want to do is go through the details of this reduction, where I start with the Hodgkin-Huxley equations, but add on some small perturbation. So epsilon is a small parameter here. Okay, well, I define the isochrons, these theta variables, in the same way as on the previous slide. I say d theta dt, what's that equal to? Well, I can use the chain rule. It's d theta dx dot dx dt. I know what dx dt is, so I can plug that in. Now, in the absence of perturbation, I have dx dt equals f of x, and I've claimed that I can reduce that to d theta dt equals omega. Okay, so if I ignore this piece, I just get an omega. With the perturbation, I get some additional term here. Now, at this point, the reduction is exact. I've just done a change of variables. What I want to do is to argue that when epsilon is small, the perturbation doesn't change the behavior that much. And so this new term here, I'm going to argue that I can evaluate it on the limit cycle x naught, which existed for the unperturbed system. Okay, so when I do that, I get an equation that looks like this, d theta dt equals omega plus epsilon times what I'll call z of theta. Z of theta is d theta dx evaluated on the periodic orbit dotted into the perturbation. Now, the perturbations of interest for this problem, I've already said a little bit about what's going on. I'm thinking of some sort of current stimulus coming into the LC neurons. This corresponds to a perturbation which only acts on the voltage equation of the Hodgkin-Huxley equations. So I'm going to think of the perturbation as being some current stimulus, I of t, and in all the gating variables, I just get zero. Okay, when I do that, notice there's a dot product here. So the perturbation is only in the voltage equation. So it turns out that I only have to be concerned with the v component of this function z. So I get this equation, d theta dt equals omega plus what I call zv of theta times I of t. Now I want to give a little intuition about what this zv of theta is, because it turns out to be very important for the analysis. This is something which is referred to as a phase response curve, d theta dv. Okay, from just thinking of what's the definition of a partial derivative, here's what it is. It's the limit as delta v goes to zero of delta theta divided by delta v. More physically or biologically, what it's doing, it's capturing the effect of impulsive perturbations on the voltage. Okay, so here I show a plot of what zv of theta as a function of, what zv as a function of theta is for the Hodgkin-Huxley equations. And let me try to explain what's going on here, why I say it captures the impulsive perturbations. Here's voltage as a function of time. The middle peak corresponds to what I'm going to call the unperturbed problem. And then what I'm going to do is say, okay, well, let's suppose that at this phase of the oscillation, I give a little delta function current stimulus, which causes the voltage to go to what it was in the unperturbed case plus 5 millivolts, and then follow what happens. Well, I follow what happens, I see that the peak of the action potential occurs later than it would have in the absence of a stimulus. Okay, What does that mean? I claim that that means the phase response curve is negative. What's happening when I do that stimulus? Remember, the unperturbed problem, I just have d theta dt is equal to omega. I define theta equals 0 to be where the neuron fires. That's the peak of the action potential. Okay, so every time you cross theta equals 0, the neuron fires. Well, here, if it's firing later than it would have had I not provided the stimulus, that means I must have kicked myself to a smaller value of theta so that it takes longer to come around to theta equals 0 again. Okay. Here I've done a positive voltage stimulus, so dV is positive, so that means that d theta must be negative. Okay, so for this phase of the periodic orbit, the phase response curve is negative. If I do the exact same stimulus right here, you find that the peak occurs earlier than it would have in the absence of stimulus. So by a similar argument, that corresponds to the phase response curve being positive. Let me go back here. You see the phase response curve for Hodgkin-Huxley, sometimes it's negative, sometimes it's positive. So I've just chosen two different cases of that. And let's see. At the risk of trying your patience, but I like to tell people about this because it took us a long time to sort out what was really going on here. And certain people certainly know it, but it seemed not to be really written up in a coherent enough fashion, at least for me to understand. You can interpret phase response curves in terms of the orientation of the isochrons as well. So let's say that we're in this phase of the periodic orbit over here. Well, this is theta equals 0, this is 2 pi over 20, and so on. Theta is increasing as I go around. Notice the isochrons are oriented like this. If I do a positive voltage perturbation, I'm moving towards a smaller theta value. So therefore, d theta dv is negative. Over here, the isochrons are oriented like this. So if I do a positive voltage perturbation, I move towards a larger theta value, and therefore the phase response curve is positive. Okay. Any questions on phase response curves and so on before I go?
For these expansions, you assume that all the functions have more than one derivative. When you're doing all these expansions, taking partial derivatives and all that, and we know that
right.
Often these things in the Hodgkin-Huxley have things close to discontinuity. So.
Right. I mean, I think that we really only have to assume one derivative. For this, we weren't. I mean, I'm a physicist by training, so for me, everything is infinitely differentiable.
I'm not a physicist.
Okay. Well. Okay.
But this is a mechanical system, which is, set up with a four or five couple first order differential equations. So at least the first derivative exists.
You have to worry about the negativity.
Yeah.
First derivative is at least exists because this is a solution.
It's defined by.
These functions are defined by first derivative. I mean by first order differential equation.
We're looking at expansion and we're looking at partial derivatives of the
set. Yeah, no, I understand your concern. The Hodgkin-Huxley equations, are analytical functions, and so, they're C infinity.
The concern is when you truncate your expansion onto the first order.
Right.
It might be that there are derivatives that on higher orders actually can be pretty big.
Sure.
It can be comparable to your first order.
Well, ultimately, I would say the proof is in the pudding. Right, sure. Sure. I mean, you can show that, for example, this equation that you obtain here is valid to order epsilon. Okay, the same sort of concerns always occur when you truncate a system. How small it is. Well, we thought about that a little bit. We don't have a definitive proof or anything of when this is valid. But as I said, I think ultimately the proof is in the pudding. And what we find is that, doing this assumption, doing this phase reduction, comparing with the full simulations of Hodgkin-Huxley, we get very good agreement. So let me leave it at that for now. Okay, So I mentioned in passing the Hodgkin-Huxley equations, as we all know, they were written down to describe a squid giant axon. And a reasonable person, even a physicist, would say, presumably the neurons in the locus coeruleus of a monkey aren't the same as the neurons associated with an escape reflex of a squid. Okay. Fair criticism. Here's more what the voltage trace for LC neurons looks like. Let me point out that they tend to fire much more slowly than the Hodgkin-Huxley equations would be able to do. Hodgkin-Huxley is always 50 hertz or higher. Here, I'm only getting one spike every 3-4 seconds or something like that. Okay, so obviously, the Hodgkin-Huxley equations are not a good model for LC neurons. What we decided to do, we looked around to see if anybody had actually done careful Hodgkin-Huxley style experiments for LC neurons, couldn't find anything. What we're going to do is to consider so-called Hindmarsh-Rose neurons as a sort of canonical model for slow firing neurons.
But do these LC neurons firing regularly?
Or is this... It depends how you phrase that question. I mean, they're certainly not every 500 milliseconds firing.
What's the CV, I guess,
and as opposed to Poisson? I'll show later on some histograms of interspike intervals. And you can see, so these are measurements from a single neuron. I mean, there's quite a spread. It's not periodic. So this type of model certainly is kind of grossly idealizing what's going on.
No, I'm just saying that, I mean, you know, you can have Hodgkin-Huxley neurons fire at low rates because of, you know, noise driven.
That's true. So sort of a subcritical.
Yeah, subcritical.
Right. I mean, we debated that sort of issue. It turns out that this idea of phase reduction is much better developed when you do have sort of what I would call a pacemaker neuron, naturally periodic neuron. Some people have made some progress for when you have a sub-threshold neuron. But, you know, we talked to the experimentalists and it wasn't clear to them, you know, is it really noise driven or can you view it as sort of being naturally firing? So we decided let's take the simpler case where they are sort of periodically firing. Okay. I'm not going to go through all the details, but perhaps not surprisingly, different types of neurons have different phase response curves. And for Hindmarsh-Rose, the phase response curve looks something like this. Remember, for Hodgkin-Huxley, it could be positive or negative. For Hindmarsh-Rose, it's always positive. And it turns out, using dynamical systems ideas, you can derive an analytical expression for the phase response curve. Okay, C is a constant divided by omega 1 minus cosine theta. Here I'm plotting omega times ZV of theta so that everything should collapse on one line. The various dashed lines correspond to numerically calculated phase response curves for different baseline firing frequencies. The solid line is a fit that we did to the constant C. And you see that, okay, obviously it's not exact, but certainly it captures what's going on pretty well.
Are those like a quadratic integrated firing neurons?
Oh, sorry. So, I should say a word about that. So, basically, with Hindmarsh-Rose neurons, what you do, you take the Hodgkin-Huxley equations, mm-hmm. you add an additional current, the so-called A current, which is a transient potassium current. That actually leads to two additional equations. And so, you have a six-dimensional set of equations. Then, Hindmarsh-Rose did a reduction to a two-dimensional set of equations. The reduction is along the lines of you replace m by m infinity because m is a fast variable. N plus h is approximately 0.8. Fitzhugh back 40 odd years ago noticed that just through his simulations and so on. So you do those sorts of arguments and reduce to a two-dimensional set of equations. Okay, they're related to Connor model, if that means anything. The form of the phase response curve can be understood in terms of what type of bifurcation gives rise to periodic firing. So the Hodgkin-Huxley equations have a different bifurcation in the background than the Hindmarsh-Rose neurons. And I don't want to spend too much time talking about that. Let me just say that we spent a lot of time classifying the different things that can happen in this paper here. Okay, so we've had quite a digression here into sort of the mathematics of modeling neurons and doing phase reductions. Let me remind you that we wanted to make predictions for the PSTHs that the experimentalists measured. So I've argued that I can do this phase reduction here. Now, let me define a density function rho theta t d theta. It's the probability a neuron has a phase between theta and theta plus d theta at time t. I can derive an equation for the density by essentially considering a control volume and saying that the rate of change of probability inside this box is equal to the flux in minus the flux out. I divide by d theta, take the limit as d theta goes to zero, and I get this partial differential equation, d rho dt is equal to minus d by d theta of all this stuff. Okay.
When do you lose from the original Hodgkin's equation by doing the phase reduction?
What do you lose?
What is it that,
what
do you have?
Well, if we didn't have any perturbation in the problem, the phase reduced equations are just d theta dt equals omega. So we've lost all the details of, you know, what the voltage as a function of time would look like. We just know that theta is marching around the circle. Of course, there's a transformation between theta and v. So if you know that transformation, you can sort of back out what's going on. When there is a perturbation, the claim is the real important details of how that perturbation affects things is captured by this phase response curve here. Okay. Again, of course, we're losing some details of, you know, the specifics of how all the gating variables are behaving and all those sorts of things. But my claim, and I'll show some results where we compared phase reduced equations with simulations of Hodgkin-Huxley, and they match up quite well. So, I mean, the main reason we're doing this reduction is because we're able to do a lot more analysis on the problem rather than just doing straight simulations of what's going on. So I'll leave it to your judgment of what actually got lost.
What's little v? It's probably
little v. So I'm defining v to just be the right-hand side of this equation. Okay, so it can be written quite simply. So the flux is v times rho. Okay, but v is actually a fairly messy little expression. Yeah, this is essentially, this is a hyperbolic equation, essentially just a simple conservation law. Basically, I won't say garbage in equals garbage out, but so the rate of change of density inside here is the flux in minus the flux out. Okay. Now, that's nice to have a partial differential equation, but we need to know what the initial conditions are in order to say anything useful about the solutions. So my claim is the appropriate initial conditions for the experiments that I described is to say that rho at time zero is just equal to a constant. Why do I say that? Well, the neurons in the LC let me put it this way. The stimulus, the timing of the visual stimulus that the monkey sees has no knowledge of what phase the neurons in the LC have, okay? So in some sense, it's a randomly timed stimulus. Okay, so before the stimulus comes on, you have equal probability of having any phase for that particular neuron. Okay, so that's why I say that rho is equal to a constant at t equals zero, and to normalize, it's just 1 over 2 pi.
But this has no random drive.
Random.
So you seem to assume the neurons actually would be periodically active.
Right. So at this point, I'm assuming everything's deterministic. Uh-huh. I'll relax that assumption a little later.
But more realistically, you would think that background firing is due to...
Sure. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So I'm assuming that what I was calling I is just equal to a constant. It's sort of a constant background rate. Again, I mean, you're seeing my style of approaching these problems. I like to start with sort of the idealized case and then keep relaxing assumptions to see what carries through. Okay, I'm going to define FL of t, FL stands for flux, as the flux at theta equals zero. Remember, the flux was v times rho. So this is the flux at theta equals zero, which is the spike point. It corresponds to the probability per unit time that the neuron is firing. Okay, theta equals zero is the firing point. This is the probability per unit time that it's firing. And in particular, it gives a prediction for a suitably normalized PSTH. Okay, so in the spirit of idealizing what's going on, what I'm going to do is say, okay, suppose we have a simple step function current stimulus. Okay, this is ultimately coming from, you have a visual stimulus processed through the visual system, and ultimately you get some sort of stimulus coming into the LC neurons. Okay, it turns on for some time and then turns off. The PDE for the density is the so-called hyperbolic equation, and we can solve it exactly using what's known as the method of characteristics. You get fairly nasty looking equations. We used Mathematica to help us solve it and came up with a nice result. But I'm not going to show you, I just want to say that because we have exact formulas, we can get detailed understanding. Instead, I want to show you some pictures of what's going on. Okay, so I'll have about three different slides like this. Let me explain what's shown in the panels. The bottom panel shows the current stimulus. Okay, so it's equal to zero, turns on, and then in this case, I say that it stays on. So the horizontal axis is time. The top panel, this is theta, this is time. The color indicates the value of rho, the density, at that theta and t value. And this plot shows the FL of t. This is the prediction for the peristimulus time histogram. The red line shows what happens for our model predictions. Okay, we can solve it exactly. So the red line is our exact formula. The blue bars indicate results from simulations of the original Hindmarsh-Rose equations for this stimulus. So you see things match up pretty well. There's a slight difference in the period. You see that the red line has a longer period than the blue. This is probably a case where truncating has messed things up slightly, or put another way, phase response curves are derived in the limit that delta V is equal to zero. Okay, they're in the limit of infinitesimally small perturbations, and here we have a finite perturbation. Okay, presumably if you were to keep higher order terms, you would get a better agreement between those two. So FL of t is just equal to, well, V, okay, I have too many variables here. Oops. So V is this quantity here. So I evaluate V at theta equals zero, multiply by rho, which is a solution of that appropriate density equation. So we have analytical expressions for rho, and from we know what V is as well, so we can just use those to get an analytical expression for FL of T. Ultimately, it comes from using the method of characteristics to solve it. Okay, well, the point of this is if I turn on the stimulus and leave it on, the density is periodic with a period that we can calculate exactly. I think of this as sort of a standing wave type of solution. And whenever, okay, red corresponds to high density, when we have high density, that's where we have a peak in the PSTH, okay, because that's, the red happens at theta equals zero. What happens if you turn off the stimulus? Okay, here I turn it on, then turn it off. Well, essentially what happens is you take your distribution and freeze its shape and allow that shape to propagate around the circle. And this corresponds to a traveling wave type of solution. Okay, and every time the red stuff goes through theta equals zero, you get a peak in your PSTH. Now, the response is found to be larger for neurons with lower baseline firing frequencies. So let me compare. So the previous slide, the baseline firing frequency is 3 hertz. The peak goes up to 9 or 10. If I take the baseline firing frequency to be smaller, 2 hertz, the peak goes up higher, up to about 12 or so. And this is starting to smell like the experimental results, where remember in the phasic state, you had lower baseline firing frequency but higher response. Okay. I had a reminder to myself to show you movies and I haven't done it yet. Let me show you a few movies here, which I think illustrate what's going on quite nicely. In this movie, what I'm doing, okay, this I'm thinking of as the phase circle. We just have a dot corresponding to the state the neuron is in. Every time I cross theta equals zero, it fires. Here I'm plotting voltage as a function of time. Here, every time I cross through theta equals zero, I put a little tick mark, and here's the stimulus. Okay, so this is just a single neuron. It turns out that I've added some noise into the simulation. So instead of the dot just moving nicely around the circle, it'll shake a little bit. But if you can filter in your mind that shaking, you'll see what's happening. So before the stimulus comes on, it's essentially going at a constant speed. The stimulus comes on, you notice that it moves much more slowly through this part than through this part. That's coming from the phase response curve. Remember, it was 1 minus cosine theta for Hindmarsh-Rose. So essentially, the phase response curve is 0 over here and is large over here. So that's why the neuron moves much more quickly through that region. Now, here's another movie. So this is a different way of visualizing these colorful screens that I just showed. So here what I'm doing is I'm saying, okay, let's assume instead of just having one neuron, we have a collection of neurons, a population of neurons, which are initially randomly distributed around the phase circle. Let's see what happens when we turn on the stimulus here. Okay. Well, you notice that you get sort of a little traffic jam over here, okay, because the phase response curve is large over near theta equals pi, small here, so everything moves very quickly through this part, but then gets caught up over here, okay. So this is LA, I guess, okay, you get these horrible traffic jams. Let me point out that after the stimulus turns off, you freeze the positions of all of these different neurons. Okay, you freeze the shape of the distribution and it just propagates around. So that's when I said that they display sort of traveling wave type behavior. Now, I'm going to show.
Diffuse after, if you keep it going for a while, presumably it all diffuse back to the original sort of.
Unit. Well, if you had noise, they would diffuse back. In the absence of noise, they maintain their shape. And so you get sort of peaks happening over and over. Yeah.
How flexible is the time scale between the onset of the stimulus and when you sort of get this bump of spikes? Because it looked like in the data it happened very quickly. I don't know.
Yeah. So.
Seconds or so, and I can't tell if that's just a free parameter or what.
Well, now, let me point out this is sort of what you're asking, I think. If I leave the stimulus on, then my claim is that I get periodic response for the density. Okay, so the stimulus is coming on at 1200. Within about 100 milliseconds, I reach the peak here. If I turn off the stimulus at that point, then I have a very peaky distribution that then propagates around. If I instead leave the stimulus on for about 200 milliseconds, I've returned to essentially a flat distribution. So now that flat distribution goes around. So the stimulus duration is quite important to the subsequent dynamics.
Right.
Okay. Now in the experiments, I mean, we talked to our experimental colleagues and so on to figure out how long should we use. I think we ended up using either 90 milliseconds or 100 milliseconds. And there's experimental data that supports using that length of a stimulus. Of course, it's a simplification that it's a step function stimulus. It probably ramps up and ramps down,
sure,
or something like that. But it, on the order of 100 milliseconds, which somewhat conveniently is what gives us the roughly the peak responsiveness in some sense. And we're turning it off when the neurons have sort of maximally clustered together.
I guess the question was, is the peak coming at the right time relative to the experiment?
Yeah,
it is.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
Just the experiment, it was 1 neuron, right?
Right, so the way we can interpret these movies.
The multiple trials.
Yeah, so the movies correspond to multiple trials. So you could think of it as a population of neurons, or you could say, well, in trial number one, the initial phase is this, and trial number two, the initial phase is this, and so on.
Okay.
Okay, so this movie here, if you remember the LA traffic jam, that corresponded to a baseline firing rate of 2 hertz. Here is more, I don't even know if Santa Barbara is appropriate, maybe Santa Barbara on Friday at 5 o'clock. You turn on the same exact stimulus, you get a bit of a traffic jam, but much less. And let me pause it. Here, in the absence of noise, you freeze the distribution, so it goes back through, so you get a bump here and a bump here. As long as you're willing to integrate, you'll keep getting bumps over and over. So let me just let that run one more time. So the stimulus comes on, you get a bit of a traffic jam over here, but much less pronounced than when you had a lower baseline firing rate.
There's a denser point, looks
like. There's the same exact number of neurons for both movies. The same number of dots for both movies.
Okay.
It might look more dense. Let me show the previous movie again. So they start out, you know, pretty evenly distributed. It just turns out that things are all kind of on top of each other right here. So it may look like there's fewer. Okay. So the movies are just a different way of looking at these results here. Now, because we have exact formulas, we can show that the peak of the PSTH minus the baseline scales as 1 over omega. It turns out this ultimately comes from the fact that the phase response curve goes as 1 over omega, although it's not an entirely trivial exercise to go from that statement to this statement. But So the higher the baseline firing frequency, the lower the responsiveness of the neuron. Okay, so we've sort of danced around this issue of noise so far. As all of you know, the brain is a noisy place, right? Okay, some people perhaps it's noisier than for others, but it's not reasonable to say we have this nice deterministic I of t step function coming in. Let's assume that we add some noise to that. And here I'm thinking of noise as just being a Gaussian white noise process, and sigma is the strength of the noise. Okay, well, we can do the same sort of, sorry, yeah?
Just to make sure that I understand the previous results. So basically, all you needed was 1 minus cosine theta phase resetting curve.
Well,
correct? I mean, so it doesn't matter if it's in the Hindemith
Rose. Right. So I mean, the scaling behavior, it goes as 1 over omega times 1 minus cosine theta. But yeah, so that that result
is just covered by the phase resetting curve.
Exactly. And just to drop a little lingo,
yeah.
So those are neurons that have that type of phase response curve are called type 1 neurons.
Okay, right.
Okay. And, you know, depending who you talk to, people may have different definitions of type 1, but the definition which I use and other people seem to use is type 1 neurons are neurons where the transition to periodicity undergoes what I call a sniper bifurcation. You get a saddle node bifurcation of fixed points forming on an invariant curve or on a periodic orbit. That's really all you need to know to deduce that the phase response curve takes that particular form.
Right, and then for this effect that you see this
right. Thing, right, so that's all, assuming that the phase response curve takes that form, then all those results hold.
Can I actually simply understand this as, suppose your background firing rate is high, that does mean your drive is higher. Initial drive is higher, right?
So right.
Your stimulus relative to initial drive is relatively smaller.
Yeah, I mean, that's...
The perturbation is kind of smaller in some sense.
Right, yeah, that's... I mean, when we derived these results mathematically, we were trying to figure out, you know, what's really going on here. And I think that's the essence of the argument. So let me just restate that in case you missed it. So to get the neuron to fire faster, you have a higher I, okay, the constant I, the baseline or the bias current. If you input the same stimulus, when you have a higher bias, the same stimulus is relatively smaller, so you might expect that there's a much smaller effect due to that stimulus. When the bias is small, it's a relatively larger effect. So I think ultimately that's correct. That's why there is this difference. But by doing the mathematics and so on, we're able to predict, you know, the actual scaling behavior, that we have this 1 over omega type of dependence going on.
So you're adding the noise in the current.
So I'm adding noise into the current. Rather than in the
motion theta, you're driving the error of t, you're multiplying it by the z of t, the noise.
The noise.
No, so you don't multiply by the c of b, you just have motion theta in your phase, rather than adding it to the current.
Right? I'm missing.
So if I look at how you added noise,
right.
Error of t, that's your stochastic error. Eta of t on the right hand
right.
Side.
Yes, yes.
And then you multiply also by sigma, which is the strain.
Right. And then the phase response curve. Right.
Related to the noise in the current. Now, why do you add in the current and not in theta alone?
Well, if I go through my phase reduction, so I had the slide which went through the phase reduction. If I go through the phase reduction, assuming that the perturbation takes this form in the current, turn the crank in the phase reduction, it turns out that noise multiplies, you multiply the phase response curve times that in order to get it. I mean, the philosophy here is really that, well, instead of a simple step function stimulus, we get sort of a noisy step function stimulus coming in. So therefore, we're assuming that the noise is really in that input current. And then theta, we're viewing as, okay, we can define these are just the isochron variables, so they're sort of fixed in phase space. And we're seeing how things jiggle around due to noisy currents. Yeah?
What if your noise were in your conductances, the original non-reduced model? So you're actually adding noise onto the current, but the conductance. You have to multiply by V, and then you do the reduction to your two-variable model.
Yeah, we haven't done that. it should be possible to carry through the same types of steps.
I don't know if it can be reduced. Do you think it can be reduced?
Well, that's what I'm asking. I don't know. Maybe it could, maybe it couldn't.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm not going to make a declaration and not know. It'll be harder.
When you're stochastic, eventually.
Yeah.
Right. This is bad enough. Okay, so the point is we end up with a stochastic differential equation, which we can then define a density as before. We end up in this probabilistic formulation with a Fokker-Planck equation, where we have a diffusion-like term here. If sigma equals zero, corresponding to no noise, we just recover the original. Okay, I can't do that. We recovered the original equation that we had. We weren't able to analytically solve this equation. You'll notice the phase response curve comes inside the derivative, which is a little bit difficult. But we can solve it numerically. So let me show some results that probably aren't going to be surprising to physicists because you know how diffusion equations operate.
So having this phase response curve inside the second derivative means that you're using the Eder formulation, not the Chernyshev formulation.
We actually did it both ways, and I believe you get the same thing both ways. Okay. It was a long time ago. This, certainly for the Edo formulation, this is the correct equation. Maybe what it is, we did it both ways, simulated it using Edo and Stratanovic, and the simulations looked basically the same.
It's always difficult to start with the because when you don't know what is that you are trying, I mean, what is the correct interpretation of that?
Mm-hmm.
So can you get this Fokker-Planck equation from a master equation where basically some coarse grained dynamics?
We didn't try that. I mean, that's certainly a good idea. And I leave it as an exercise to the audience to try to do that.
Wait,
but
so you're saying instead of putting in the noise by hand, yeah, can you come up with something?
You just write the differential problem.
You write step evolution by master.
Right, we haven't done that.
It's not even clear that that's where the noise is supposed to be.
Sure.
Sure. I agree.
Although it is totally reasonable to think of sort of random synaptic implants, right, and occurrence.
But then it would be, if it's synaptic, it doesn't should be conducting.
I think the question is whether this noise term, that is why it's considered to be a fast limit of something that's correlated, and then you would get rather Sartorovich than. But well, it can well be that there is not much difference.
I mean, I can't say for sure that we get the same equation both ways. But we did do it both ways and do simulations, and they looked virtually identical. So from that perspective, it didn't seem to matter, really, which interpretation we took.
So physically, this is just like patching on? Is that the story? And then just adding in these random bursts?
Yeah.
I mean, we're thinking, it had been mentioned that there's various time scales involved here. We're sort of thinking we have some fast fluctuations that we're not really willing to model. Yeah, much faster than sort of the natural dynamics of the noiseless system. Okay, so with appropriate provisos, okay, this is what we find. Noise leads to a decay in the ringing of the PSTHs. Okay, so basically, you turn on the stimulus, you get this traffic jam type behavior. Turn off the stimulus. Well, even while the stimulus is still on, things have a tendency to diffuse away from each other. Okay, so here the red line is from our simulation results of the reduced system. The bars are just adding noise onto the Hindmarsh-Rose equations and simulating those. And not surprisingly, larger noise strength gives a quicker decay in the ringing. Okay, so I've increased the noise strength. You see that here the peaks are decaying relatively slowly. Larger noise strength, they decay quicker. Okay, let me remind you, in the experimental results, you had essentially flat here, you had a peak, you had a depression, and then you essentially return to baseline. So we thought, okay, well, in order to match experimental results, perhaps we should include noise to sort of smear out this, what you might refer to as ringing behavior. Okay, here it just turns out analytically we can determine how quickly things decay. Let me just skip over that. Okay, so we wanted to match the experimental results, and we played around with different noise strengths, at least the way we've included noise in the problem. We weren't able to get a real good match with the experiments. So we talked to our experimental colleagues, and we said, this is what we assume, this is what we assume, and they said, well, you know, it's probably not reasonable to say that this neuron has a firing frequency of 2 hertz. The firing frequency is actually going to drift over the course of an experiment. Different neurons have certainly different firing frequencies. Sometimes we make a PSTH where we might not be using the same exact neuron. And so we realize that both noise and some distribution of frequencies is going to be important. And we wanted to sort of tune, of course, this introduces more parameters into the model. We wanted to tune the parameters by some comparison with experiments. Here's a histogram of the interspike intervals that I mentioned before for the neuron. By tuning the noise strength and frequency distributions, the mean and sort of the variances of the distributions, we were able to get a pretty good agreement between the data, which is the gray bars, and the model, which is the solid black line. Okay, so we tuned our parameters like that.
Yeah, I'm sorry, this is the reduced model and you're putting in noise?
Right, this is the reduced model. We put in the noise of the strength. And then essentially what you can do for these frequency distributions, we sort of assume that the frequency drift is a slow time scale compared with the natural dynamics. And so basically what you can do is just calculate for this frequency. For this frequency, add a weighted sum between those two. Well, actually weighted over an entire distribution, and get what's happening for that whole frequency distribution. Okay, so we're not dynamically allowing the frequency to drift or anything like that. We're sort of just saying, okay, for the first time the monkey sees the stimulus, it might be at 2 hertz. Next time it's at 2.1 hertz. Next time it's at 1.9 hertz with some probability, and then average all that out. Okay. I'm nearing the end here. I know that these talks are always supposed to be an hour, and they go an hour and a half, but hopefully you have the patience for just a few more slides. I've ignored one aspect of the problem so far. I mentioned it on an early slide, but that is that there's some difference in synchrony between these two states. Remember I said in the phasic state, the neurons tended to be more synchronized with each other. In the tonic state, they're less synchronized. That's captured in the data with so-called cross-correlograms. Here you measure the firing times for two different neurons and make a histogram of the difference in firing times. For the tonic state, that's the black line here, it's essentially constant, which means if one neuron is firing, there's no preferred time at which the other neuron will fire. Whereas for the phasic state, which is the gray down here, you have a peak at t equals zero, which means if one neuron is firing, it's more likely that the other neuron will be firing at about the same time. Okay. Well, in order to get these types of effects, you have to consider populations of neurons that are coupled to each other. Okay. We considered a weak coupling limit. Okay, when you do weak coupling, you can do phase reduction. Much like what I described so far. And you get some coupling between the thetas corresponding to the various neurons. Okay, so we say that theta I is the phase variable of the ith neuron. We get a term which turns out to be some function of theta j minus theta I, and you sum over all j's and so on. So part of the reason we did weak coupling was because our analysis allowed us to do that relatively straightforwardly. But also, it was able to capture the key experimental behavior. So here's for our reduced model in the presence of both electrotonic and chemical synaptic coupling, which experimentalists tell us that both of those seem to be important, with the noise, averaging over distribution, the whole shebang. Okay, you see that for the tonic state, the cross-correlogram is essentially flat. Phasic, you get a bump. Okay, well, things don't go down as much as they should have in the experiments. We played around a bit trying to get things to match up better and ultimately decided that this wasn't a crucial enough issue. We've shown that weak coupling can give the effect that we were interested in. And when you throw everything together, you still get the response to stimulus behavior that the experiments show. By that, I mean when you have a lower baseline firing rate, you get a larger response. Okay, so when you add in the noise and average over frequency distributions and couple everything together, everything still follows through. Same story as what I presented before. Of course, the details are much messier. But the same things basically hold.
Why
so,
is the noise-free one better than the noise-free one? The model? Yeah.
So when you have noise, it's spreading things out. And the peakiness here, well, let me point out before I say that, the bars here are not the experimental data.
Oh.
The bars here are simulations of Hindmarsh-Rose equations. Okay, so it does turn out that, it looks like, well, it's debatable whether or not sigma equals zero for the model matches the simulations better or not. But what I want to point out more is that the trend is correct, that the peak here, okay, any line that you want to take, either noise-free, model with noise, full simulations, the peak here is higher than down here. And the only difference is here I have a higher baseline firing rate, lower peak, lower baseline firing rate, higher peak. Okay, so by making the simplifications that I described, we can understand the scaling behavior between baseline firing rate and the peak, but in order to match the experimental data, we really have to throw in all of these other things. For those, we're not able to do such a detailed mathematical analysis, but the story carries through pretty well. Okay, so let me wrap up here, summarize. So I've been talking about locus coeruleus neurons, how they behave during a visual discrimination task. I modeled the LC neurons as Hindmarsh-Rose neurons, then reduced to a phase model in the presence of some external stimulus. We were able to use this to make predictions for the peristimulus time histograms that the experimentalists get quite excited about. This leads to a Fokker-Planck equation. We're able to show lower baseline activity gives larger response. Noise gives the decay of ringing. In order to explain the experimental results, though, we had to incorporate both noise, frequency distributions, and weak coupling. Some other applications, let me just show you. We did a little more than this. This was sort of the most coherent story that you can pull out of what we did. The experimentalists, of course, devise a bunch of other tasks, okay? Instead of having the monkey always look at horizontal and vertical bars, sometimes they would have the monkey look at one, the monkey would be presented with one of these four stimuli. It was supposed to respond by either pressing a right button or a left button. Okay, so what I like to do at this point is to see if the audience is as smart as the monkey. What is the monkey supposed to be looking for in the stimulus to decide right or left? Well, is it the majority? So here there's four left and one right, and he's supposed to press right. Okay, so it's the monkey's supposed to just look at the one in the middle. Okay, whatever direction that's pointing, they do right or left. And it's a harder task because these are called distractors, the stimuli that you sort of want it to ignore, but you allow it to, or you want to make the task more difficult. Here's the experimental data for a PSTH for this particular task. It looks quite a bit different. Okay, it's flat before the stimulus comes on. You go up, but instead of sort of a depressed firing and then a return to baseline, it's more of a monotonic decay coming down. So what we did, we took our model, which we sort of tuned all of the parameters for the visual discrimination task, and tried to see if we could get something that looks like this. What we found is that with a step function stimulus, it's impossible, essentially, to get a PSTH that looks like this. So what we had to do was to assume that you have a different type of stimulus. We call it a shark fin stimulus. Okay, it ramps up and then decays down. And you also had to assume some distribution of stimulus onset times. Okay, why are these reasonable? Well, this is a harder task to do. Okay, so it may seem reasonable that the various processing units which feed into the locus coeruleus, particularly sort of cognitive units that might be feeding in, are going to ramp up more slowly and then perhaps decay away. Okay, perhaps, perhaps not. It's impossible at this point to experimentally measure what's actually coming into these LC neurons. But we did find that you have to assume a different type of stimulus. Yes?
Does that make you a little nervous? I mean, that, you know, you change the task, I mean, I guess fairly substantially, but nonetheless, you change the task and the volume. I mean, there's a lot of degrees of freedom in choosing what the stimulus is. So.
Right. I mean, what we tried to do was focus on stimuli that seemed plausible biologically. You know, we could come up with some crazy stimulus that turns on, turns off, turns back on, something like that. And that just didn't seem like a reasonable thing. So, I mean, basically, I think this should be viewed perhaps more as a prediction that for this type of task, the stimulus which is coming into this region of the brain must be, at least, you know, the simplest thing that it could be is this. Whereas for the visual discrimination task, it's probably it ramps up or ramps down, but perhaps the build-up time and the decay time are much faster. Okay.
That's only got one informative item in there. So presuming that the monkey in his training has learned this, why is that more difficult than the other one?
Well,
other than there's now the presence of other items
yeah,
that are totally not
I mean,
informative.
We can't really get into the mind of the monkey, but right. Even though it's been trained on this, it's still, after it's done it for 10 minutes or so, you know, it might be, you know, not paying quite as close attention as before. You know, and so, you know, it does take a little bit of work to always be looking at the middle stimulus. And I honestly don't know. It's quite possible that instead of having the stimulus always in the same point in the visual field, they moved it around a little bit so that the monkey always had to tune in a little closer. I don't remember that detail, but that's the sort of thing that could be done to sort of keep it as a more difficult stimulus. I mean, these monkeys learn these tasks very well, and then once they know it, you can't...
It's not a more difficult task, it's a more complex
stimulus. It's a more complex task, that's probably a more precise
Well, I would say it's a more complex stimulus. It's an equally simple
task. I think that's fair. Yeah?
You could actually imagine watching the dynamics of how the response changes from the first stimulus set to something more like this by sort of adding in these stimuli with, you know, at darker and darker.
We would love to do that.
And how the dynamics of this.
We weren't able to really piece apart all the data in order to do that. I mean, this represents perhaps a month of testing or something like that, and done by various people who passed through the lab. And I mean, there were various aspects of the problem where we wanted that exactly, to sort of figure out how the monkeys learn. You know, how does this PSTH change as they're learning the task and so on. And at this point, we have to just say, well, we need to start with a new monkey in order to get that sort of data. Well, that didn't seem to be important when they were training the monkeys, so. Let me just mention, and I've alluded to this, you can do a similar analysis for other types of neurons, so-called type 1 neuron. It has a sniper bifurcation in the background. The phase response curve goes like this. Hindmarsh-Rose is the example of that. Turns out there are four different, what you would call codimension 1 bifurcations to periodicity. Codimension 1 basically just means you vary one parameter, and you can go from not being periodic to being periodic. And the other example, saddle node bifurcation periodic orbits, that's what Hodgkin-Huxley equations are like. Phase response curve goes as basically just a sine function. You can have a supercritical hop bifurcation, Fitzhugh-Nagumo type equations often behave like this. You can have what's called a homoclinic bifurcation, Morris-Lecar. Phase response curves look different. The point is different bifurcation, different phase response curve, different response. And here is just some idea of what different neuron types, how they behave. Here's the density plot, theta and time. Here's the PSTH. These are all, in some sense, equivalent stimuli. Of course, the period for the different neurons is different, but we took it to be some fraction of the natural period. And you see, I mean, I don't want to go through all the details, but you see that you can get quite different types of behavior. Also for integrate and fire neurons, you can do similar analysis. This is the last slide. Let me just mention one exciting direction which I want to take this sort of work. I mean, it's nice to figure out what's going on in the actual experiments, but you can also think, well, different stimuli give different types of response. This seems to be related perhaps to synchrony, all these issues. Well, there's a therapeutic technique called deep brain stimulation, which has been approved by the Food and Drug Administration for treating Parkinson's disease. So in a nutshell, the problem with patients who have Parkinson's disease is that neurons in a certain region of the brain are synchronized when you don't want them to be synchronized. And that leads to sort of an amplification of some rhythm, which ultimately leads to the shaking behavior. The idea of deep brain stimulation is to implant an electrode into the offending region of the brain and inject some sort of current stimulus that might be able to desynchronize the neurons. Okay, so this raises a lot of questions. I mean, it broadly raises the issue of how do we understand the response of populations of neurons to different types of stimuli? Is it possible to come up with, in some sense, an optimal stimulus which is going to optimally desynchronize these neurons? Or perhaps for other diseases, you want them to be synchronized and they're not synchronized. Can you inject some sort of stimulus to synchronize? Of course, this is a fairly last resort type of procedure at this point. Okay, you're implanting a piece of metal into someone's head. You don't want to do that lightly, but it does seem to be a fairly promising approach. And up to this point, apart from a researcher, Peter Tass from Germany, apart from this point, most of this work has been relatively trial and error. And so what I'm hoping to do is use similar techniques to what I described in the rest of the talk to determine how can we sort of optimally desynchronize neurons due to these stimuli so that we can make this type of procedure as uninvasive as possible. Okay, so I'll leave that with you as a closing thought, and thank you for your attention.
Yeah. So a movie of a guy that had involved in Parkinson's and electrodes.
Right. Yeah, typically what they do, well, in the past at least, what they've done is they've injected very high frequency sine waves, essentially. And that seems to work fairly well. But there are certainly indications based on the mathematics that a better thing to do is to first of all turn on a step function stimulus and then turn it off for a short time. That sort of primes the system. Then you turn on another step function stimulus, and if you choose the durations appropriately, then that very nicely desynchronizes things. So I haven't seen that movie, so I don't know what specific stimulus was used there, but my guess is it was probably one of these rapid... Right. Oh, they're very interesting. I've seen movies of people with Parkinson's who, if they focus on some other task, like throwing a ball up and down, they can walk perfectly normally. But then when they stop doing that, then they shake and aren't able to do anything, or they might freeze. They're not able to open a door. But when they're throwing a ball with the other hand, they can do it as if nothing was happening. So there are a lot of interesting, you know...
Just to sort of understand the big picture.
Uh-huh.
As far as I understand, it's well known that if you have a set of nonlinear oscillators sitting close to each other and communicating with each other, then eventually they synchronize.
Well,
under some conditions.
Yeah, I mean, there are certainly conditions of.
So basically, what you have done here is to show that a realistic oscillator, in the sense of, I mean, realistic question is actually an oscillator, is in that particular class that is a synchronized, and you've shown the way actually how to study you know, the speed of synchronization, how fast they get there. And
right.
Basically, is that the main message which you should take?
Yeah, I mean, one sort of sub-message here, which I don't know if it's appreciated. So remember when I was showing these movies and you get sort of this traffic jam sort of behavior, you could view that either as a bunch of realizations for the same neuron, or that could be a population of neurons all receiving the same stimulus. Now those neurons were not coupled to each other. They weren't talking to each other. But just through the stimulus,
Coupled
through the stimulus. So just because they all get the same stimulus, they're able to synchronize. Now it turns out, and I've...
Basically this is a mean field sort of model where sort of interactions between neurons, you're looking at sort of an average effect, an average field which affects all of them.
Right, so you could view, they're all feeling the same stimulus.
In this case, we're actually certain that if it's even, this is a mean field problem, that there is going to be a phase transition somewhere there, and you will get synchronization depending on particular point and what's the force, whether it's large or small.
Right. But let me point out, I've done some simulations, I haven't pursued this fully yet, but I've done some simulations where I have a a collection of neurons and that are not coupled to each other, and they're all receiving distinct Poisson inputs. And you get similar synchronization phenomena there as well. So even though they're all receiving different inputs, you still can get, this is often referred to as phase resetting, you still get these phase resetting type effects. Of course, it's stronger when they all receive exactly the same stimulus and things like that. But it seems to be a fundamental issue that, you know, when you turn on a stimulus, that's going to cause the phases to all shift, and they're not all going to shift in the same way. Depends on the phase response curve.
But certainly if they do not talk to each other, if the stimulus is totally random, then phases should not become the same.
Well, they don't become the same. They're not going to fully synchronize, certainly. But you can still get some partial synchronization. That's what my simulations seem to show. Simulations of, let's see, what level did I do it? I think I was doing it at the level of the phase equation. So I just simulated N phase equations with Poisson inputs.
This actually seems quite strange, because if you have a really random stimulus and you have really uncoupled neurons,
No, I agree. It seems.
Just move all of your stimulus and take a single neuron and move the stimulus with this neuron received by 5 milliseconds back, and it still should synchronize to the bunch, right?
Well, I think what must be happening is that. Certainly the timing of the stimulus is important, and so the same stimulus at this time and this time lead to a different phase shift. And so, you know, on average you can view that the stimulus is coming, you know, at a totally random time, but for stimuli that come in these phases, that's going to lead to this set of responses, and then stimuli coming out at this time lead to a different set of responses. These responses are perhaps stronger in some sense, so those responses always kick you back. So then when you average everything together, you get some non-uniform effects coming in. I don't know if you buy that or not, but I mean, that, as I say, I haven't pursued that fully, but just based on the simulations, that seems to be possible. And I think that that's, you know, if that's true, it's a important message.
Well, isn't that just, you know, sort of like what Fred and Theo Geisel and all these, like, in Theo's talk, right? It was just, yeah, I mean, you can have, if you have a single pulse and you have neurons distributed in phase, then that pulse, depending on the phase resetting curve, can have a bunching effect or a dispersive effect. Just because neurons that are advanced in phase from some phase zero will get pushed towards it and the other ones will get.
Yeah, I think if the phase response curve were flat, then his intuition would be correct, that it doesn't matter. But if the phase response curve is not flat, then you're going to get some bunching effect even through these random stimuli. I mean, when I have time, when my daughter's quit getting sick and so on, then maybe I'll pursue that. All right. All right, thanks.